Oh, this one. I wasn't able to check this out, but why does he come anyway and ask them if he, after all, he's a member of the team, and I can't believe the president over here.
I'm looking, you weren't able to check it out, but since he's not
the more I think about it, I can't believe the president checked.
Given that he's such a,
all right,
close member of the team.
Thank you very much, that's very kind, this is.
You want to turn the chart over?
Yeah, I'm in front of it.
Or I'll tell you what, let's put one in.
Put another, yeah.
One of the old ones,
yeah.
Schweitzer.
Hi, Schweitzer. I'm the Secretary Carter. Nice to see you, Secretary.
I'm going to see you tomorrow, I guess, huh?
I'm Howard. What are we doing?
Oh, I thought we were having lunch with you.
Yeah, we are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're
going to educate me?
Around the things?
My partner?
Educate me?
There you are, the only plus in the picture. What I've been saying. Pete, we've got a little deal in hand with the Japanese this week, which we haven't been talking about. We're going to brought them in the area, Mandarin Oranges, and sold in as a seed solid. That's something they have raised. Now this has to have a very routine, but we can announce this week that we're ready to go on trade. And this has had enough visibility back in Japan, absolutely.
You talked to Investor about the East Ranger building companies?
No, I have not, but I have to go to the president. In fact, I talked to the president about it Friday and so on. Because it's not too late. And I'm just kind of raising this question with you. This is kind of a couple of things I have for face to him. Five states. Pick up Montana, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Illinois, which will get more popular. Thank you. Gentlemen, at our last meeting, you recall, we seemed to agree on some new directions based on a rapidly changing position in the United States and the world. We agreed to set up some priorities, which we did. I think, Mr. President, it's a mild understatement to say that August 15th changed some of those priorities. So one of our main purposes here today is, given the fundamental nature of these moves, to take another look at where we want to go and what our next steps ought to be. I should emphasize that we don't have much time, and I know that I'll be successful in this request, but I would hope that you could withhold your questions and comments until the end. It seemed to me that a worthwhile place to start, particularly in view of the President's new economic policy, is to ask ourselves, in a sense, longer term, what do we want and how do we get there? And it occurred to us that it might be useful to kind of start out with what's been the administration's policy of a liberal trading policy and ask what some of the premises were of that trading policy. And ask these questions not so much to change the policy, but to see if, where it isn't operating the way the system is supposed to, we can hopefully change it in some important ways. It seems to me that the basic premises of a liberal trading system or policy are several. First, that maximizing the real income of consumers was really each country's primary goal. I think what we find as we look at the system operating in practice is that the consumers are pretty badly organized in most places in the world, and industries and labor unions and farm organizations are not so well, are much better organized. With the result that I think there's a question, at least in some countries, as to whether that's the primary goal or not. Certainly a second premise has been a free flow of goods, labor, and capital, and no export just for export's sake. A third very important premise has been the premise of international specializing, where countries focus on the areas where they have the largest advantage. And in that way, we could maximize the real income of everyone. Now, it was certainly assumed, I think, in the premises of this system, that this adjustment process would take place smoothly and it would be politically palatable. And I think it is perfectly clear that this problem is a much more difficult one, perhaps, than was assumed, and needs a lot more attention than it's gotten if liberal trade practice and theory is to move together. In our long-term policy of liberal trade, there were certainly rules of conduct that I'll briefly mention. One, that everyone would more or less follow the same rules. Secondly, that the total system would remain in balance and equilibrium. Some critics call this the dreamland of equilibrium, because in actual practice, whereas it was assumed that there would be no extra unnecessary building of reserves, where it was assumed that revaluations and devaluations would be equally likely, as we look at the system the way it really operates, we find that this is not really the case. Let's take this assumption here of no unnecessary building of reserves. I take Japan partly because we're going to be meeting with them next week, and also because perhaps they're the most dramatic example. For instance, it was assumed that people would not build up unnecessary surpluses or reserves. Let's look at what actually is happening here. The Japanese this year will have a trade surplus of nearly $6.6 billion. Their reserves have moved up. This is pre-August 15th, incidentally. There's obviously been changes there. We asked the CIA, Mr. President, if they wouldn't put together a composite of the various kinds of economic plans that the Japanese have done, both their official agency and some private agencies they use. Now, without saying explicitly whether this is their country goal or not, it is interesting that as one looks at a composite of those goals going out 5 years, they were projecting an $11 billion trade balance and $20 billion worth of reserves. Now, the point here is that it is extremely difficult for some countries to have objectives like this and still have equilibrium in the total system. For example, we're about a third of Japan's exports. It's very difficult to see how we could have the balances we need to pay for military and and devaluations would be equally likely. And that's the mechanism that would be used to balance. Now, one of the difficulties I think the system's running into is that the IMF does a pretty good job with weak currencies. But I don't think anyone quite envisioned that you'd have strong currencies that are now present in the case of Japan and Germany. This is something the Council of Economic Advisers put together. And I find the way the system works, compared to the way theoretically it should work, quite interesting. For quite a few years, we've had a big deficit, as you know, in our balance of payments. Theoretically, under those circumstances, the value of the dollar in relation to other currencies would obviously have changed. They would have revalued vis-a-vis the United States. Well, let's take the last 10 years. In spite of these major deficits, the dollar has gone up in value about 4 or 5% over that same period of time, which suggests that that there is not the same tendency to revalue as to devalue. And this, in turn, aggravates seriously this disequilibrium situation we find ourselves in. Now, another very important assumption here in the system was that each country had an obligation to avoid more or less policies that exploit the other countries, or that stimulate domestic growth at the expense of others, so-called beggar my neighbor policies. One of the things I think we see in the system that's troublesome is that some countries not only export their products, but in a way export their domestic problems also to other societies. And let's see what's been going on in the last few years. I suspect when the history books are written, part of the big crunch that the system's had in the last year or two is that the world economy has been in what Fortune calls the stagflation worldwide. And if you notice here, gentlemen, if you take the last year or two, there's a definite falling off in the industrial production trends of virtually everywhere in the world, even including the Japanese. Now, given the export orientation they have, I suspect this is something that's put a great deal of pressure on our own trade balance, and certainly one of the major factors. But much more broadly, I think it is safe to say that it was assumed that each country would more or less solve its own domestic problems at home rather than exporting them abroad. Now, let us see what the impact of this is on our economy. I think John Connolly and Paul Volcker put together some numbers, and check me on this if I'm wrong, Paul. But the feeling is we need a trade surplus in the short term, somewhat in this area, in order for us to have rough equilibrium. We have such a trade surplus in 64. This year we have this kind of a deficit. I think it is an interesting question to ask. What does this trade difference here amount to in jobs in the American economy? Now, many of us, of course, are accustomed to saying, well, trade is only 4% of our GNP, it's 13% of our products produced. Ergo, most of our unemployment problems should be solved in sectors that have nothing to do with international economies. Of course, that's right. On the other hand, at the margin, this important shift, we have an estimate here from Commerce, and I think Labor's been involved in this, about 575,000 jobs is occasioned by this difference. Another estimate is 750,000 jobs. Now, if the system had been working properly, the only point I'm trying to make is that this would have amounted to about 0.7 to 0.9% of our workforce. And I must only submit that had our unemployment been 0.7 to 0.9 less, the entire political climate in this country, vis-a-vis trade and other matters, would have certainly been different. Now, on the monetary side, I'd just like to, I think it's clear to everyone that at the heart of some of these most important problems is that the monetary system is not working the way it was assumed to work. I'd like to just give you a very brief progress report on the monetary situation. This is not the forum, I think, for any detailed discussion. Treasury and the Volcker Group is leading that effort. But let's very briefly take you through the monetary seemed to be to get a sufficiently large exchange rate alignment, which along with improvements in sharing of defense and aid and marketable trade, would put us in a satisfactory balance of payment situation in the 72-74 period. And this is going to require an improvement of quite a few billions of dollars. So that's the immediate requirement. But I think we all agree also that of fundamental importance is the restructuring of this monetary system so that it works the way the system assumed it would work. And here again, Treasury and the Volcker Group is taking the lead on this. I'll very briefly go through some of the issues that they're grasping. Rules and authority for setting of equitable parities by all, I emphasize by all, because what we see here is some countries using an undervalued currency, I think, is part of a national policy. And it's important, I think, to explore whether a new system can be developed where people follow the same rules in the setting of their rates. This includes the possibility, incidentally, that perhaps we would want to be able to initiate parity changes. Added flexibility to make these changes more continuous, more palatable politically, and smaller. How do we provide additional liquidity? In the past, I think our deficit has more or less provided a lot of liquidity. How would such a system work? We've had lots of problems with short-term capital flows, as you well know. There's all this question of the role of the dollar versus the role of gold. What kind of convertibility? Paul Volcker later can report to you on the kind of euro-dollar and dollar overhang we have, but it's a very important problem. Certainly an issue is what do we do about foreign investment restrictions as part of this package? And I guess Paul Volcker, in something he's written, refers to the World Central Bank. The IMF has simply not functioned as a powerful force. And if we're going to restructure the system along one line, at least, the IMF is going to have to play quite a different role. The Treasury Volcker Group have come up with three broad options that they're now working on. One is a basically reform system, liberal trading, multilateral cooperation, and major changes of the type that we're talking about here. The second one is a more regional kind of block system, and the third is a floating world kind of system, as Paul calls it. I think, Mr. President, rather than get more into this at this point, we ought to wait and see if we have time, and then John and Paul Volcker can answer questions on that. A second important piece of work that I think the August 15th initiative certainly emphasizes is the importance of taking some important initiatives soon. Again, without going into the detail, we have work going on in Japan. Canada is becoming an extremely important situation to be dealt with. The European Community at large, that's more or less on the bilateral side. On the multilateral side, these are the pieces of work going on. You know about the OECD Trade Study Group. I should say that Congress and many others are growing increasingly concerned, I would say, about CAD and its effectiveness and its viability. And we'll have an important study, if you approve it, to really take a look at how CAD should function. Cliff Hardin would like us to spend a meeting, I'm sure, on this important subject, and I think we should at some meetings, but agriculture is a very important problem worldwide. If we have time later, I'll show you that agriculture is really one of the very few major categories in 71 that's up vis-a-vis the previous year. We depend very heavily on that positive balance. But around the world, we see very high subsidies, artificial prices, very little production controls, people exporting their problems, and I think we need a bold approach to this problem. And finally, we have next steps of the new economic policy, the need for some positive new initiatives. I think many of us feel, gentlemen, that the steps we've now taken were absolutely necessary and fundamental. But sometime soon, we should probably think in terms of some kind of forthcoming positive initiative so that the moves we've taken do not look too self-centered or protectionist or perhaps even overly nationalistic. The next area which we think commands a great deal of attention is the whole adjustment process. And the thing that's happening here is partly as a result of our overall employment problem, but partly as a result of the fact that the market penetration rate in the United States has certainly accelerated in the last 5 years, is the increasing penetration of key markets. We have time later. I can qualitatively different, is that the rate of penetration of important markets is accelerating in the last 4 or 5 years, which certainly aggravates the political as well as the economic problems. Now, if we're going to have a very bold adjustment program, which many of us think is absolutely essential, one of the problems is, what's it worth to us? And I think most people would say we spend very little money, actually, in this arena. Well, there are lots of ways you can look at what it's worth. From the consumer standpoint, here's a study that's been done by the Federal Reserve Board that simply shows that on shoes alone, just to take one product, the difference between having a fixed quota and not having a fixed quota would probably end up costing the consumer nearly $2 billion extra in shoes at a time when we're trying to keep costs down, reducing the rate of inflation. One of the cost benefits we've got to think about here is the cost of certain products. Now, this is simply one problem. Again, on adjustment assistance, I'll simply cover the headings because we have a lot to go through today. Most of the people think we need a much better early warning system so that we can get preventive action before we're confronted with a crisis. On many of our problems, the problem is just politically a crisis by the time we get to it. What is the relationship to other domestic adjustment problems? I look at you, John, and Carol Clinton, and I remind myself that we've got unemployment compensation, we've got fringe benefit, retraining, and regional development. Import competition is really a special case of a broad problem of how we help industries adjust. How should these programs relate to the other programs that you have? Jim Hodgson could speak volumes on this. We think the principal problem that we have, perhaps the principal psychological problem, is how to get labor's cooperation on it. I needn't tell anybody as sophisticated as you that if you talk to labor unions about adjustments, what they're thinking about all the time is that each of them runs their little political empires with their members, and what they're concerned about is how many members they're going to have and what kind of dues they're going to have. And when you talk about adjustments, you're really talking about less members for them. Now, Jim and his people have some interesting thoughts on how we might be able to make their cooperation and adjustment program in their interest. Role of temporary orderly marketing mechanism. Should we have some rules on this? Now, I know that even posing this kind of question will bother some. On the other hand, I'm constantly asked, as I'm sure some of you are, you seem quite willing to make moderating agreements on textiles, on shoes, on steel, on other products. What are your criteria? Are you willing to talk about having voluntary or non-voluntary arrangements that moderate growth on other products? What is your policy, in other words? What makes electronics different than these other products? I think this is not just a U.S. problem, but an international problem. And certainly the most important problem on adjustment assistance is how do you shift our resources and people into new methods, new fields, where they are economically viable. I think, Mr. President, in many ways, it's the contrast between welfare and rehabilitation, between burial, which is what adjustment assistance is widely called, and renewal. And if we're going to put our emphasis on the industries of the future instead of getting locked up in the industries of the past, somehow, we think this is where the emphasis belongs. A third important part of our program, we believe, has to be more emphasis on exports. And not just for economic reasons, but for political reasons. I think the political realities are that import industries are much better organized than export industries politically. Now, here's the kind of rate of growth over the last 10 years in exports. And it can be seen here that obviously, part of this depends on the base, but if you take this 10-year period, our growth has been considerably smaller than other countries' growth has been. Our share of exports, as we've seen earlier, has gone down. Now, we believe that export promotion should be a very important part of our program, both for economic and political reasons. These are the various programs that we have, DISC, and there's some other incentives that other countries use, export financing. There's an antitrust problem. By and large, President, if I were to look at the Japanese success in exports, one of the several very important reasons is the way they've been able to mobilize through large trading companies, the smaller companies, to participate in exports. In the United States, by and large, we haven't done a very good job. Very important. do we wish to raise that issue? Now, there are other issues on exports. I don't think this is the right forum for them. Mal Laird, I'm sure, knows that there are questions in that area about military exports, particularly certain aircraft, which I appreciate have important considerations other than export. And another very important issue is the east-west study area. You may remember that at our last meeting we showed you the way that trade is growing, and we'll simply make these very brief points, that it's growing extremely rapidly, that in total now it's about $9 billion each way, and that our share is obviously very small. You will recall asking us and Commerce chair the task force to do this, to tell you what the magnitude of that opportunity is in terms of dollars and to make it a realistic conservative goal. Maurice Sands, I think, believes it's too conservative, but the indications are, and I think almost everybody agrees it can be at least this much, is that if we were to lift the restrictions in 4 years, we could have about $1 billion worth of trade. And here's how it would break down. And it would add about $400 million to the favorable trade balance. Obviously, there are many political foreign policy considerations here, but you'll remember asking for the economic side, and I think we could add about that much at the point that you think it's appropriate to move. You're aware, I'm sure, of the growing business pressure from businesses to loosen up in that area. A fourth area where a lot of work's going on, and we think important area, is the whole policy with regard to investments. Last time you recall, we covered the investment picture, and I'll simply make two or three quick points. We obviously have an enormous stake in our foreign investments abroad. This number now, I think, is close to all the perhaps $78 or $80 billion overseas of direct investments. Second thing is, on our balance of payments, you may remember that our gross income now from our foreign investments is nearly $9 billion. So without this, we would have probably a much more serious balance payment situation. And the final point we would like to make is we have a fair amount of vulnerability, as we know, with that much money abroad. And I still hear how much money others have invested in the United States. And something like $12 billion has been invested in the United States, whereas number about six, 7 times that large now has been invested abroad. So we have a lack of symmetry there in our vulnerability. Now, what are the main issues here? We think there are several. Perhaps many of you have read of the concept called the mature creditor concept. The argument runs that even in the reasonable short term, we should be able to find a trade deficit quite acceptable in view of the rapidly growing investment interest. We think it's very important to nail this one down. I think I can say that studies, at least Paul, that you have done, suggest that that's a very optimistic assumption of the rate of growth of investment income. But we think we should get a government view on this matter. The other issues, I think, we're aware of with one possible exception. What we're going to do about controls on U.S. investments abroad, expropriation, you'll be getting something this week on quite a lot of work that's been done there. And certainly the multinational corporation, the effect of this corporation on trade, balance of payments, capital movements, and jobs is moving up to the head of the agenda. Those of you who've seen Labor's legislative program know that essentially it's quotas across the board, blocking investments abroad and blocking technology. And the villain, if I can name one, Jim, it would be probably is the multinational corporation. The argument is that they're essentially exporting jobs, and they've used numbers like perhaps as much as 50% of the activity of multinational corporations is aimed at exporting jobs. We all agree, and a major work is now underway to get at this problem, that we know much too little about what multinational companies do on jobs. I can show you some data that Congress helped us prepare after a lot of work on what we know through 68, but we've got to know it in much greater depth than this. Whereas labor argues that as much as half of the activity of multinational corporations is aimed back at the United States. In 68, it would appear that while the number, the amount of the product coming from foreign manufacturing affiliates of U.S. companies is growing, 4%, 7%, 8%, and while the number isn't important, the important point is that over 90% of what our manufacturing plants do abroad is to attack foreign markets and get a share of those, which reflects itself in our investment income. But we think it's going to be very important for us to answer this, because this is where the labor of emphasis is now being put. Technology transfer, at least in my view, is going to be a very important policy issue we're going to have to deal with regard to what we do about technology. And again, labor is got that very high on its list of priorities. Let me illustrate. Remind you of a chart I showed you the last time, just to refresh your memories, of the Japanese case. You remember our showing, these are Japanese royalty payments abroad. This is what they pay out in investment income. These numbers are extraordinarily small if you compare them to other countries. And these numbers in relation to these are very large. Now what's happened, of course, is that Japan has had two kinds of restrictions on high technology products. One is on investment and the other is on exports. And I think many American companies, knowing that they could not get either into the market in order to make their products or export them in the case of computers and high technology products, sold their technology. And I think we should also say that we were encouraging probably many of these companies to do just that. I think the policy question we're now presented with is that one of the premises of a liberal trading system is open markets to exports and capital and trade. What the relationship should be between our willingness to export our technology and that country's willingness to accept our exports and our investment. And it may well be that we'll need to take a fundamental look at this question of what our policy should be with regard to exporting technology. This area is, in the eyes of many, an important thing we probably should be doing a much better job of. I think all I need to do is remind you of the advantages of stimulating more foreign investment in the United States. It would help us, I think, on our balance of payments problem. It would certainly help us on the jobs front. And it would certainly help us on the vulnerability front. And there's some active programs underway of stimulating other countries to invest more in this country. On the legislative front, which would obviously come out of all this, I think our views are twofold. One, that while your new economic policy has certainly taken some of the heat off very short term, all of my inputs at least say that labor is not, by any stretch of the imagination, going to give up on its three-part program of cross-the-board quotas, technology, and investment. And we need to work on a contingency plan both to fight that and to decide how to respond to that. On the positive side, we can see a program emerging in the next few months, including the following elements: export promotion, as we've mentioned, what to do about impacted industries, the whole adjustment problem, and perhaps some other legislative authority to give you the authority, as we propose major initiatives, to have the authority to be, in fact, able to negotiate. And, of course, if you decide to go further on East-West trade, you'll probably need some legislative authority to do that. The final part of this presentation deals really with the issue of our own domestic economy. I think the more we look at this problem, the more clear it becomes to us that if we do not have a strong domestic economy that is growing and competitive, it's going to be very difficult for us to have the kind of open world that we want. And we're seeing the results of that, I think, in the last few years. Last time, we went to unit labor costs, as some of you may remember, of various countries. Here's some data that go back over 10 years, and this covers only manufacturing, and as all of us know, a lot of our productivity problems in the service business, not in the manufacturing business. But even in the manufacturing area, one of the reasons your new program is so highly relevant to our country's problem is that you can see this distinct flattening in our output here per man hour. And as I said earlier, if we don't get more productive and grow, I think almost whatever else we do, we're not going to be able to have the kind of foreign economic policy and foreign policy that I think we all want. Now, as I read this council's charter, we're supposed to try to help bring together and coordinate foreign policy and domestic issues. And while in most of these cases, I don't think our council is the place to do this work, I would hope you would agree that perhaps one of our roles is to identify some of the problems as we see them. We've already taken some very important steps. The new attitude of what we might call the Nixon Doctrine of Economics and the competitive spirit of getting back to work is certainly being very well articulated and I think, from what I can see, well received. Modernization of U.S. plant equipment. The reason I use the word modernization, our critics on this investment tax credit keep talking about underutilization as though the only issue was quantity. I think there are several reasons why this is not the case. In a competitive world, it's the quality and modernity of that equipment that is urgently important, particularly if you're trying to get productivity improvements. And quoting figures about how a certain percentage is not utilized made this the main point. For example, we're unable as present to get the data we wanted, we hoped we could, that would compare in detail the age of U.S. plant versus the age of other countries' plant. One fair study has been done of the Japanese case, and it suggests that 77% of their plant equipment is 6 years old or less. Now, I would have no way of proving that the U.S. plant is older than that, but I would be very surprised if it isn't substantially older than that. So you have the modernization issue. Another reason we need this capital, of course, is if we're going to provide these 20 million new jobs we talked about. Peter Drucker, I think, makes an important point in an article he's written on how much capital it takes to provide these new jobs. He estimates that a lot of these new knowledge and skill jobs require about $20,000 of capital per job. Now, where is that money going to come from? And obviously, profits is one place where it can come. And sometimes I think, at least I've been inclined to forget what a plateau we've been on, really, in terms of corporate profits. And this is the sector we're talking about here, essentially the manufacturing sector. And to notice in absolute terms, it's very flat going back about 5 years. But of course, in relative terms, when you take into account inflation and the growth of the GNP, it's not only down substantially, but these dollars buy less, obviously, than they did 5 years ago. I simply go through this because I think we're in for a lot of criticism on the investment tax credit, and it's important, I think, that we have some of this background. The third area that we've talked about in many forums, including our last meeting, is enhancing the U.S. industrial technological position. It's a very important part of any program of providing growth and competitiveness. Now, there are many, many ways one can look at what our industrial technological position is. I don't mean to suggest that this is a comprehensive look. You really ought to do it by sector of technology. Commerce has prepared this, and I think it's simply one symptom that seems to jive with what most students say in the field. And that is, if you look at applications of the United States Patent Office and argue that before a guy submits a patent, most of the time he's going to think he has something in place that's worth patenting. You can see here that going back 10 years and using the U.S. number as the base, it's remained fairly flat. But if you look at the foreign patent applications, you can see that they've nearly doubled in that period of time. So that now there are about 45% of the U.S. patents. Lots of similar indications, namely in our trade balance and other places. But everything that I see at least suggests that this technology program is a high priority. Now, this study is being handled in the domestic council. There are a lot of inputs to it. Commerce has got some important ideas, I think, on this subject, and I believe John had given this project to Bill Magruder, who, from my discussions with him, is very much on top of this problem, and I understand you're going to get a presentation on it. But to bring our people up to date, I think, in general, what's being talked about is general stimulation of R&D, in short, letting the private sector, in important ways, decide where it thinks itself it can put money, and then targeted stimulation. And I think that some of the newer concepts of the present in that program, as I review it, are some way of combining social benefits with economic benefits. And we tended to think that if it's social, it doesn't have much to do with the other and vice versa. But I think Bill Magruder is very well aware of the fact that it's quite possible to take areas that do provide industrial growth, productivity, jobs, trade effects, and at the same time meet some of the social problems that we have. There are also very important questions of how we get this innovation turned out, including a subject that the President's been interested in, I know, which is this whole subject of how you get quality of invention in government programs, how you get development and demonstration. And the tendency as a businessman, I think I can say this, to launch programs before we're at all sure we have a first-class idea or first-class demonstration of what that what we have is really good. Most projects, Mr. President, in industry, the vast majority go through this invention feasibility stage, and you draw the majority of the projects, because when you finally, you know, look at it in the hardware, in the prototype form, it costs too much, or it doesn't work, or it's patented, or something of that sort. And the bill is working hard on how the government should really stimulate. And certainly organization and implementation is another, where should it be located and so forth. There are some specific policy issues here in the technology transfer and antitrust areas are important. The fourth area that we talked about the last time, a great deal of work has gone on as a whole. You'll recall our discussion of the whole antitrust area and the relationship that has to competitiveness. Again, John Ehrlichman's people have done a great deal of work on this. I think if this council has any direct contribution to make, as John and I have discussed, it's to see what the particular aspects are of foreign competition that relate to this. There's questions of what kind of mergers, for example, can be made abroad. Many foreign countries, as you know, prefer joint ventures. Our joint venture structure, I think you'd agree, John, is a little ambiguous in this country, let alone abroad. How do we feel about companies diversifying as part of the adjustment process? See, Mr. President, one of the things businessmen tell me is quite frequently the best adjustment process is to diversify. Now, if you're a fairly large company, you're having a problem in some important segment of your business, a merger may be the cheapest way of getting your resources spread elsewhere. And I'm sure you're aware of some of the problems that are involved there in that kind of merger. Multinational companies have some special problems. Export trading companies and web palmery are certainly related to us. And finally, if you were to decide, as a matter of your program, that you wanted to pick certain large fields where you wanted to concentrate government and business resources and technology, I'm sure, John, there are going to be some very interesting antitrust questions that are raised in that kind of an activity. We've been inclined to do rather little of this in this country. The next area that affects our competitiveness is the energy and raw materials situation. I think we decided to resolve our last meeting that some of the other things were higher priority, but I think we're now at a stage where I would recommend this move up our priority. Just to give you an idea here, you remember our reviewing with you, the very strong trends toward having to import a good deal more of our raw materials as you look to the end of the century. We've been doing about this much. It now looks like in the next 25 to 30 years we'll have to be importing this much of our product. Now, in raw materials, we have a great deal to do with our competitiveness in the world economy. Aside from vulnerability, there's the question of competitiveness on cost. Show the Japanese case in a moment. They have been doing a great deal of 20 and 25 years purchasing of raw materials at very favorable costs. Many experts would say at costs that are better than the costs we are now getting. But there's no question raw materials is an important part of competitiveness. Certainly there's a vulnerability issue here. Balance of payments effects, we're now having some studies made of what growing raw materials does to our balance of payments. We're far from having a clear view. There are different views on it. But as you know, we're going to have to import large incremental amounts of oil in the future. And we have to see what the effects of this might be on our balance of payments. What the government's role should be, as you probably know, that there's a recent commission on materials policy, a national commission on materials policy. And I guess part of what we have to decide is how much priority we put on it. I think I would urge us to put a rather high priority on this problem. And very important, I think, the policy decisions needed on what role research should play in your priority of technology products in developing substitute materials. We all recall during the war the major effort that was put on synthetic rubber and nitrogen, synthetic power in a sense, nuclear power. And I think as John goes through his projects, to what extent we want to develop our own substitute materials will become an important policy question. Having suggested that jobs is a very important part of foreign economic policy, at least as I live in the real world here, it seems to me that another very important question is this question of providing 100 million U.S. jobs by 1980, and what kind of manpower policies and planning we want to get involved in order to achieve those objectives. So we can position 20 million new jobs in this decade. I am told by experts that that number is about 40% higher annually than the last 10 years. This is due, of course, to the demographics of the ages of children that were born 20 years ago, essentially, when we had that sudden increase there. Now, I guess one of the questions is, are we having an emerging problem of jobs in a way that perhaps we can't quite understand why the problem is as intractable as it is? We see certain pockets of very real problems. In the 16 to 25 age group, we talked a great deal about the blacks and the problem we have there. But as we know, even the whites, the average unemployment rate is about 3 times the average United States. And I take it quite a few of these didn't have a pretty good education. We see certain areas of major oversupply. One of the most dramatic, I guess, is in the field of education, where we've turned out many more teachers than we apparently need. And some would say by a factor of perhaps 4, 5, or 6 times more than we need. Some say we have many too many college graduates. I'm not saying I know the answer to this, but I am simply suggesting that we may be running into some serious structural problems here. We know about the aerospace problem. And yet, at the very same time that we see this oversupply, we have great shortages in other areas. Some experts tell me that we're only training about 35-40% of our requirements in health and various technical fields, laboratory technologists, mental assistants, computer technicians, and so forth. Another group tell us that as you look ahead to the way the world's changing toward more skills and more training, one expert says we probably should, in our high schools, be training about 8 out of 10 in some kind of skill training, some kind of training that enables them to relate to the new jobs of the 70s. And yet less than 1 out of 4 are getting this kind of training, and much of it, I think, is oriented to the past rather than the future. I might tell you a personal anecdote from my previous company. The fastest growing part of the entire company is in the field of skill training. And what we've discovered is that the public sector is very slow to respond to the new requirements of computer technicians and electronic technologists and so forth. And that I suspect that this whole question of what kind of training and what kind of jobs are going to be available is going to move up on the agenda, would be my guess. And it's related to this issue here of jobs. Jim Hodgson tells me that at the adult level, that much of what is now done is at the entry level, as I understand it, Jim, and we do rather little in the upgrading level. Now, as you talk about new technologies, new companies, and new industries, you have the problem of what these people are going to do as these new industries emerge. The issues, I think, involved in this are fairly obvious. How high a priority should be put on an unfinished job goal, and what do you believe the level of government responsibility should be for achieving that goal? And then what kind of policies achieve it? To what extent does one rely on overall growth, overall level of economic activity? And to what extent does one get more deeply involved in trying to predict what the jobs are and get the people ready for those jobs? I guess all of you know that Sid Marlin, the new Commissioner of Education, has some very strong views about what he calls career education and thinks that our education structure needs to be fundamentally altered to provide more training that really prepares people for the new kinds of jobs. And of course, in Jim Hodgson's area, I guess there's a question of what kinds of new government programs are required, or government-private programs. The seventh area, I think, is the area of projecting future development in the United States and the role of goals and projection of plans. And I know this is not an uncontroversial subject, but I think as one looks around the world, he's at least entitled to ask whether the kind of projections that other countries are doing do have relevance to our particular country. Not that we copy them, but what are the lessons that we might learn? The Japanese case, which I would certainly not think is appropriate to the United States, is a system that does do a great deal of defining the future and defining the goals. I mentioned earlier, Mr. President, the raw material arena. If you look carefully into their plans as a country, you will see that they have some very specific ideas about where the raw materials are coming from, where they're going, how they're going to get them, and they have some fairly specific targets that industries are going to emphasize and how they're going to get from here to there. Finally, having said that I don't think that kind of system is appropriate for this country, it still leaves the question as to what kind of projections and goals that planning, if any, makes sense for the United States, given the market system, the private sector system we have. How should an effort be organized? Where does it belong in the United States government? Now, the President has approved a low-profile bipartisan group that will be co-chaired by Roy Ash and Ben Hyman, who will very quietly start this month looking at this important question of what kind of projections make sense in this country at this time in its history. As one important example of a piece of work that I think is very important, is to look ahead to the middle and latter part of this decade and ask ourselves what kind of an industrial, manufacturing, and employment base is the U.S. likely to have, at least in terms of its basic industrial sector, aircraft, steel, automobiles, electronics. Are the concerns over our becoming a service economy justified? We hear this frequently. Obviously, the changes in the monetary system will have quite an impact on that. And what kind of an industrial manufacturing base do we want, and what kind of a price are we willing to pay to get it? It seems to us that even before this work is done, it's important, and I suspect this council, this might be a place where this council should play an active role, is to look ahead and answer questions like this. Productivity and competitiveness comparison in major industrial sectors of our country versus others. What are the investment plans of American companies? Many people believe, labor in particular, that the United States companies are planning rapid expansions of their manufacturing abroad as they learn how to work with foreign plants. Another question that's part of this are what are the likely effects of new combinations of capital, technology, and low labor costs in selected, less developed countries? I think most of us, when we were taking our course in our early courses in economics, used to think that low labor costs and low capital and low technology went together. But in this new world, what we're seeing is that capital, technology, and management become very mobile. And the companies are now learning how to export their management and capital and combine it with low labor, which in a sense is a rather new ballgame and has some important implications. The question is, how far is this likely to go? To illustrate this, interest in trying to get the kinds of plans that various companies had. And I don't for the moment suggest that we know how significant this is, but it's simply put up here to suggest that the image we used to have of less developed countries making textiles and shoes and sandals and bags and that sort of thing is likely to change, and perhaps significantly in the 70s. This is Hong Kong, Korea, Taiwan. This is a list of companies across there. And here are specific products that we either know are currently being made in significant quantities or are being made. I think, Mr. President, as you go down that list, you will see that some reasonably sophisticated products now are beginning to be made in these less developed countries. Computer arena, quite a few computer people are now exporting memory drones, for example, integrated circuits, devices of that type, with their management, with their know-how to these countries. So we think as part of this study of where our manufacturing base is going, without getting alarmed by this, we should simply try to make a reasonable 3 to 8 year projection to just see where this manufacturing thing is going. But I'd like to sum up now, I think, telling you what I think we have tried to say today. I think what we've tried to suggest is that this liberal trading system needs to has many advantages, and instead of discarding it, we ought to try to make it work the way it's supposed to work. This certainly means that in this monetary area, there's an enormously important piece of work to be done. In this whole adjustment process, we think there's a great deal of work to be done. And if we're going to preserve our worldwide statesmanship position, leadership position, we think we have to take some initiatives where we might set out some challenges to the world. For example, the kind of thing we might visualize when we get this monetary thing settled. For you to challenge the world to certain kinds of major liberalization, let's say, like a 10-year period. Or we might say that if these changes are made, we stand ready to eliminate certain kinds of barriers. But we think it is important that we put ourselves on the record there if the other countries do, in fact, make the adjustments that we think are appropriate. Aside from the international economic system, I think what we've tried to say today is that a strong foreign economic policy begins at home with a strong domestic economy. And that if we want a liberal trading policy, we can have the best international economic system in the world. But if there are questions about whether we can provide jobs and grow and compete, in a sense, that's the necessary requirement of an open world. Essentially, our story today, we welcome your questions or comments, or if you have directions you think we're overlooking. You'll notice, Mr. President, you told us to look at priorities pretty carefully. You've heard very little discussion of foreign aid. I think our view is that over the next few months, at least, given the kind of problems we have, this is not as high a priority problem as it is going to be taken care of. Do have questions about the monetary situation, we have two experts here. Sit down and try to answer the question.
I think it would be well to focus briefly on the problem with regard to the Japanese movements here. If you'd like to start on that, Bill, on some general comments and beyond, you might have something you'd like to say.
Well, Mr. President, I think this probably is the most important meeting of its kind we've had in Japan since World War II. I think we're pretty well prepared now on how it should be handled. Treasury and State Department, I think, are in accord, and we've submitted a recommendation to you about it. The reason it's going to be particularly difficult, I think, is that they are very weak politically at home. Their own government is split up into factions, and they're disagreeing on everything. So they will want to have some assurances from us of a general nature, certainly. They're suspicious about us. They don't quite believe us. Now, they don't say that, but they say it to other people, and you can tell. Comments and so forth. This is position given very much by way of specifics, except to tell them what we want them to do in a general way. And we have a list of eight subjects that we're going to talk to them about and tell them they have to take some action, etc. They, on the other hand, are going to press us for why if we do these things, what are you prepared to do? At that point, we're just not going to be prepared at this time to answer. We're going to be able to point out that we won't know until after the monetary meeting, 10, probably until much later than that. So it's going to be a very difficult exercise to give them the assurances that they need that the relationship existed between our two countries and the rest of the Pacific area, for that matter, are going to continue to make them do or force them to do the things that they must do to help us with our problems. Taking into account the fact that they do have this very big subpolitical situation at home, plus a depression of their own, they have a difficult economic situation. So that our ability to answer their questions is going to be quite limited. We're going to be able to tell them what's wrong with them and what we think they should do. They're going to press us very hard on us what we're prepared to do. Every indication should have been answered, you know, Mr. President, against the delegation. Yes, is a very strong supporter of the United States and man appeared at least a while back to be the successor to Sato. We're not sure whether he holds that position now or not. He's lost ground. First, he has a health problem. He's rather frail. And secondly, he is under attack by opponents in the cabinet itself, particularly in Lapierre. And so he is going to be very shaky himself. He's going to want to get as much support and attention from you and the rest of us as he can. It's going to be a difficult exercise. Now, it seems to me our position would be stated this way. So we should be firm and tough in our entire discussion. Make it clear that they've got to face up to these matters. They should have faced up to a long time ago. At the same time, we've got to be quite aware of their sensitivities in public comments, particularly, because whether they are as guilty as many of us think they have been in the past or not, the fact is that they are the linchpin, as you said, the linchpin of peace in the Pacific. Our whole policy revolves around Japan. I was interested when he went through this exercise, and I incidentally think it's an excellent exercise because it points out how many unanswered questions we have in our own government. We have a lot of them, and those unanswered questions are going to become apparent as we talk to our friends abroad. It's interesting to notice that the areas where we expect danger and difficulty in the future involve our very best friends in the world, Brazil and Latin America. Brazil and Mexico, they are two best friends that we count on the most, the stabilizing influences in Latin America. In the Pacific, you mentioned Taiwan, Korea, Japan, Indonesia. We've been doing everything we could to cultivate Indonesia. Same thing, of course, is in Europe. So that the difficulties that we're going to have in this field in the future are point directly to our friends in the world and the ones that we've cultivated. And I think in the case of Japan, I was my other comment, we have to keep in mind that most of the things that they have done, or at least many of the things that they have done, which are now criticized in this country, they did at our request. For example, on the defense aspects of it, they point out that we tend to be quite critical of them and say, why don't you do more to buy away defense expenditures? They point out, we want to, but we've done exactly what you asked us to do. You were the ones that provided in our Constitution, made us include in our Constitution, talk to others in the area, in our area of the world, we're not sure they want us to build up heavy armed forces here. Now, in the trading area, we've taught them a lot of these things, as you say. We've encouraged licensing in Japan. Now, it's come back upon us, but we must keep in mind that, as far as the Japanese are concerned, they're very sensitive to these subjects. I think the meeting will go well. I think we're well prepared, Mr. Person. I don't think there's anything we have to decide this morning. One other thing that deserves comment is that every nation that we've dealt with, without exception, starts off by saying that what you did was sound, necessary, bold, comprehensive, and they admire you for doing it. So in our dealings with all of these countries, we start out on a very good basis.
I don't think that
the other nations, the Indonesians, because that trolley occupied them.
enough to keep the, and it's very much to our interest, we're speaking here, of course, I don't love this very much in this room. It's very much to our interest. Never use the terms play one against the other, but if you're going to have a peaceful Pacific, or for that matter, a peaceful world, it is much more to our interest to have Japan be not only economically strong, but some military punch, then they balance the Chinese. And for that matter, they are a little bit of leverage against the Russians. And having them with us is terribly important. Now, having said all that, having them with us is absolutely indispensable. So to make these arguments economically, we have to realize that we build them up militarily and the rest of the we've got to be very tough with them because they're going to be tough with everybody. As David Kennedy knows, you think that the Lebanese are hard to deal with, try to deal with the Japanese. They're harder.
But the answer to Mel's point, maybe we should underscore as Bridget said, that is all those nations in the area are suspicious. If you go to Korea, Indonesia, Thailand, Taiwan, and ask whether we should stimulate a large build-up of Japanese military strength, they'll all say, take it easy.
Yeah. As long as U.S. base builds, sure, they'll do that, but it's down to...
I'm not saying, they say fine, they should spend more money, but don't do it too quickly, too massively.
And also, don't do it if we get out of Asia. There's the other one. That's where we'll be talking about the next doctrine. See, as we get out, as we draw down in Korea, of course, out of Okinawa, down in Taiwan, and down in the Philippines, the rest, and you'll leave that vacuum. Well, who's going to fill it? Well, actually, the Chinese are there to fill it at a proper time. And these other nations know very well that none of them can fill it. And so the Japanese. So these are the political sides of it. Now, having said all that, the immediate economic problem, because there may turn out to be a military balance in any event, regardless of the Japanese, too, there's got to be some sort of balance. And the whole game has changed. That's what the China war is all about. The game has changed. There are players in the game. And nobody can predict what it will be. But economically, whereas we are somewhat uncertain about what the political side is going to be, we know that economically the Japanese are potentially our number one competitor, and also extremely tough and highly controlled. It's very interesting to note Pete's comments about their planning. Now, of course, that happens to be anathema to me. I don't want to see that. I don't want to see us still go that far. Most of us don't, except for George Shultz. Nevertheless, on the other hand, anybody who's been to Japan, as Dave has, some of the rest you've been there, Nash, for instance, and you sit down with those trading company people, we talk about the Japanese government, the fights within the government and so forth. Hell, that's not the government. The Japanese government and the Japanese business are one. And they run it. I mean, it's one time it's Mitsui's in the head role, and sometimes it's Mitsui, and now there's a third one that's Sumitomo just about to take it to the other side. Well, we all know. But the trading companies and so forth, the Japanese business and other communities, they sit down there. There used to be ninja houses, now there's a little bars and so forth, and work everything out. Very pleasant way to do business. But anyway, nevertheless, we now come to how we deal on the economic side and so forth. John, talk a little bit.
As far as I don't have much to say except
for all the banks, all the major American business enterprises. They had them all over the world doing the same thing. Now, I agree with Bill that we ought to have a very good meeting with them. I don't think we can give them any answers, because when we tell them, generally speaking, and that's all we can do is talk in very general terms, what we have to have, they'll throw a shoe like everybody else does. They just say, well, we can't politically do that. But I think we have to recognize that they're a whole lot tougher than we are. In many ways, they're smarter than we are. They're more selfish than we are. And there's no point in kidding ourselves.
And better organized.
And much better organized and controlled, sure. And then they constantly lead and spring.
I think what we have to realize is, from an economic standpoint, the Japanese, and this is something that some of our unsophisticated American business people may not understand until they go over there and try to deal with them or get an investment. So just try to get over 50% control of the Japanese, even today. But the Japanese are as totally controlled in their foreign economic policies as the Soviet Union. As totally controlled. That you look monster. It doesn't mean that you go to the government to get it done. Go to the trading company. That trading company doesn't do one damn thing unless it fits into that pattern. That's the point that we have to realize with these people. Would you agree, John, sir? As a totally controlled economy. Now, within the country, they have, of course, and this is where they have the enormous advantage over their totalitarian friends. In the country, they have incentives and competition and all the rest, and therefore are quite productive. But in their posture toward the world is controlled posture. Now the question there, John, and which I think you and I talked about this, but we talked this too. The question there is whether the United States can deal with, looking at the world in the future, the Japanese, apart from their internal situation, looking outward with a totally controlled attitude. Of course, the Soviet Union, a totally controlled attitude. The Chinese, 15 years from now, when they amount to something, a totally controlled attitude. And maybe Western Europe. Not totally controlled, but more controlled than it is. Now, how can the United States then play its game? Its game where the Antitrust Department, Justice is the representative here. Well, the Antitrust Department has to make look at it from one standpoint, from another standpoint over in commerce, another standpoint over here in the rest. And it may be we can play the game that way against these totally trophy companies. We could at a time when the only potential competitor down the road 25 years ago was the Soviet Union, if we could beat the hell out of them. But now, we have to realize that these big guys in the game, that we must not make the mistake of looking at that internal economic policy and say, well, gee, they're like us. Free enterprise and all that. Sure, it's free enterprise. But not in their foreign policy. Their foreign policy, subsidy, loss leaders, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. So the poor American businessman goes around and says, what can you do to help us? We don't do one damn thing.
Well, Mr. President, to address myself for a moment to Mel's point, we don't have to build them up militarily. We spend, the Mel says $500 million, my memory of the figures, are up to over $600 million a year for facilities in Japan. They don't have to build up their military machine to help us. They just pay for those facilities. They're building an aircraft industry. They don't have to build an aircraft industry. We got three commercial aircraft out there over here that need work. They can buy ours. They don't have to build it, but they want to be self-sufficient. Now, be the devil's advocate for the moment. There's not anything Japan has in the long run that we need. On the contrary, she's a competitor. And she's the only competitor in the Far East for everything that we want. She's a small, tightly controlled, industrialized nation that has nothing to give us except cheap products. Now, if you want to take just consumer attitude, yeah, she can give us lots of things. She can give us everything, as a matter of fact, though. But in the long run, she's going to be competing with the United States for raw materials, for influence,
for military strength. We took on her now as a great ally.
That's fine.
But who the hell caused this trouble in the last 25 years? Only Japan. We could make common cause with Indonesia or Korea or even China. China didn't cause us the trouble that Japan did 25 years ago, and I don't know what the next 25 years will bring. But I think we first have to approach it from the standpoint of economic strength and economic self-sufficiency, both domestically and internationally. Now, if we don't do that, I think we ought to set out on a long-range plan to take in a way to bring Japan in. Sure, we have to have her as an ally. And she ought to be an ally. She is an ally. And we ought to have every ally in the world we can get, Japan and everybody else. But to say that we have to deal with her at all costs, I think it's a great mistake. And I just, I would suggest by any standards that we even hear this from the media over here, so I'm getting off the track somewhat. But I think, both in the immediate and the intermediate range, we ought to start sinking off Japan. We ought to start diluting their influence because she'll turn on us. I think she's a completely selfish nation. She's shown it before. She's shown it many, many times in the past. And I don't know why we rely on her as our principal ally in the Far East. I wouldn't do it for a minute. But that's another subject now. Pardon me for getting over. I think we have a good meeting with the Japanese here, and I think we have to. Just say something that Bill has pointed out, that we've got some problems that are critical of us. You're part of the problem, and they want us to give them answers. That's not the... I'd rather check and be in a position to raise. I'd like them to come forward with something. They've got a pretty substantial awareness of what they do and what they ought to do, but they know what the problems are. We just, if Paul Volcker has been saying to the countries in Europe that we have to have a swing of about $13 billion in our trade balance to make up for a lot of these things that we're spending money for. And they all shudder. They say, well, politically, we can't do it. And that's what the Japanese people say, politically, we can't do it. But politically, somebody has to do something. And I think we just have to hold their feet to the fire and be as nice to them as they are to us. Just bow a little bit lower than they bow and smile a little bit broader than they smile and just still hold that knife to them. Just as firm as we can.
Just as one aside, and I don't know whether it's the same as what you mentioned on this situation. It is still a possibility. Peculiar from those that are on and I know better than most is one of the most decent truths which you've read.
Precisely.
And very much. He's a former finance minister. He's a he's much more precise than Sato. And I think, to the extent that any Japanese should be, shall we say, pro-American, and I would not even, I would not trust that either over the long haul with anybody. I think if you'd like to get him as, without putting our armor on him, give him a chance of hurting Japan, give him as much building as we can. He's good to talk to, too. I don't know.
That's right. I'm going down to Williamsburg tomorrow and have a session with him. I'm going to put the knock in separately, but to have a couple of hours to session.
Can I make a couple of comments about Johnson? Because I don't. I agree with you on it. But you asked why we rely on Japan. We rely on Japan because it's the only nation in the area that we can rely on. My whole foreign policy since World War II has been based on that premise. All of our treaty commitments based on that premise. We felt that China was the enemy. And that's why we entered into the CETO Treaty. That's why we have the security treaty with Japan. That's why we've gone to such lengths to be sure that it could be extended without a national debate in Japan. That's the basis of our position with Korea. so that if recognizing there are two nations in the area with great strength and great potential strength, one is Japan and the other is Communist China, how do we manage? Now, up to this point, our position has been Japan, as the President said, is the linchpin of peace. Everything is revolved around that. We've tried to prove the strength. We've tried to provide. Also, one of the reasons we've had troops in Japan, we've had troops in Okinawa, is to slowly permit them to build up their military strength in a way that does not cause the other nations in the area to become alarmed. And now we are gradually pulling out. We've reduced our troop strength, as you know, in Korea, Japan, Taiwan, Thailand. And our policy is that we will gradually have Japan build up its military strength, so hopefully on the basis that we can trust them. Now, we don't trust them, we shouldn't trust them any more than we trust anybody else, Germany or Communist China or Russia or anybody else. But the fact of the matter is you have to have friends and allies in the world, and our whole security position in that part of the world is based on it. So I would hope that we would not even, you know, as much as we condemn for some of the things we've done, I would hope that we have a basic trust in the fact that our alliances are going to continue to work. They don't show any indication of trying to build up military strength. One of the reasons they don't is because they know we suspect them. That's why they've got such a concern about nuclear power. We have been trying to get them to sign the non-proliferation treaty. A lot of the leaders want to. Others say you can't trust the United States. We may need nuclear powers. So it's like most things in the world, it isn't totally one-sided. And I think our policy in the Pacific is a sound policy. And I think the fact that the President is taking the step he's taken to improve our relations with Communist China comes at the right time. But we mustn't do it, I think, in the spirit of now get even to those little yellow devils. I just think that's the wrong way to do it. It shows our whole foreign policy down the drain. Describes it completely if we approach it that way. Well, now, another thing I think we've got to keep in mind is if this government goes down the drain, what will happen if the communists will gain? I mean, China's point is to do anything they can to weaken the government. Because there's a good deal of communist support in Japan. And we've always been quite concerned about that, that Japan might become communist. And the present government is certainly not communist, or they are not communist. But if as a result of our actions, the present government should be thrown out, and the communists make great gains, it will have a serious political impact in this country, just as we were accused of losing China. After the war, we'll be accused of losing Japan if it should go that way, so we certainly don't want that result.
Well, no, you don't expect that to happen, do you, Bill?
Well, I think
Otto is under pressure, but the party's
not. Well, I think that
the party is very strong.
I mean, the
possibility or chance of the party being affected.
Oh, yes. We think there's a good possibility that the left-wingers may make political gains. We don't think they're able to control the government at all.
But my gains, yes.
Well, even gains of that kind will be significant.
They've got a period of election for next year.
Yes,
or running solid, so it's next year.
Yes.
So you've got a period there. But Sasha's under pressure. He's not anything.
First is a lot of nonsense that we ought to get out of our heads. I'm working on a speech that I'm going to make later this week. Speech, rather, I don't know which department he got it from, but we'll assume because I knocked it out that he was out of his own head. But in any event, he had one phrase in there that we favor competition with other countries because good competitors make good neighbors. Well, that's just bunk. The point is that if you look at the great wars of Europe, they were fought between people of the same religions, people after that. They expect to play. Now, on their part, they will play a very hard economic game. They're hard economic competitors. And then, of course, they will look to their political ties, alignments, and so forth, and play it that way, too. Let's take our British friends. They're playing damn hard. The common market, they're apparently not rolling over very easy with regard to things that we want from them. And that's the way it will be. I think with the Japanese, what really is, what has changed is this, and I think we all agree with this. What has changed is that as of 25 years ago, 15 years ago, even 10 years ago, the United States felt it was to our interest, of course, to have a strong Japan, strong economically, strong enough economically and with enough stability that they would resist the socialists, and particularly the communist wing of the Socialist Party, which was then strong 10 years ago, and they came pretty close, so forth. So we had done that. It was much to our interest to do that. And so much to our interest that we opened up our markets, and we didn't bitch too much about their closing down to our investment, and we didn't push them too much on defense and all the rest. This was in our interest at that time, because they were very weak. The figures on steel are talking, it's just hard to realize how they could have done it. The figure that Japan, 20 years ago, produced 5 million tons of steel, and this year produced 100 million. It's all changed. Now they are strong, they're vigorous, they're very, very good competitors. And I think the key thing here, the key thing is privately dealing one way and publicly decide something else.
We're all in the
privately, it's terribly important for the Japanese because of their concern about face. And we've got a hell of a lot of concern about face too. We don't like to admit it, but we do. Privately, they understand, and it's always done with great politeness, that they understand. Fox say, look, we've got a hell of a problem, you've got a problem, but let's get along with it. But believe me, don't sign any deals until you get what we need. On the public standpoint, we want to come out of these meetings, and that's why I'm going up to see the emperor and all the rest. The rest of the idea that, sure, the United States and Japan are great competitors, but we're great allies. We're going to be great allies, sort of like that. And that we're going to find ways to solve these problems and so forth. But boy, in any of the deals, it's now they're big boys able to handle themselves, and we've got to make the deals that are as effective as we can without conflict. That's what it gets around to.
Mr. President, if I could try to bridge what I think I heard Bill Rogers and John Conley saying, it seems to me the essence of a good partnership is to have compatible goals. And I think if there's one message we should all try to get through, is that we've got to have trade and economic and balanced payments goals that are worked out together, rather than having them having goals that the only way they can attain them is at an unacceptable price to the United States. And I think from everything I've seen, the kind of projections they've made would be unacceptable to us. So I think we can further the partnership idea if we say, here are our goals, what are your goals, how can we now make these compatible?
What do you have as a devil in mind? Addressing to another subject, when do you plan to be ready, or do you plan to be ready on our research initiatives and so forth and so on?
Well, this is John Price. I mean, excuse me, John Arlington, when is it, John? You're already
That's ready for presentation now, Mr. President. We're trying to get it on your calendar as soon as you have an opening. And it would take a matter of an hour and a half, I would guess, to make a presentation to you. And then there's a whole series.
What is this getting that raising it?
The appropriation for the National Science Foundation.
No,
I hope not.
It's along the line of T outline, got here.
Huh?
It's along the line of T outline, but here. And addresses this subject of how we mobilize and better use all this money that we're appropriating now.
Marshalling our assets. The reason I raised the money is that every time we put up research on time to have a college president, for example, they say, and that helps us raise the level of, for our associate professors and all the rest of their
trickle account about it. Yes, there's now no strategy. There's no national strategy for the employment of all of our treasure that we're putting into research and development. And the idea here is to think through first what our strategy should be. What markets do we want to penetrate? What job goals do we have? And these kinds of strategic goals. And then how do we, as the government, bring about the direction of all of this money to cause research and development to be done to achieve that strategy, to carry it forward. And it's a very broad, obviously very broad subject, but there are a number of very specific things that we think we can do on a short range basis to begin to move in a much more satisfactory direction. Where, for example, are tackling the problem of the new NASA or that sort of thing, which is a very exciting proposition.
Could I ask John if you would, maybe you would call it, so that we could all know to what the situation is on the international monetary. As I understand, we're keeping our powder dry and not moving until we get ready to move. But could you spend it?
London and Rome and Paris,
I guess, as well,
where he's just been attending a meeting of the deputies of the Group of Ten. And I think that really will give you the flavor of what's happening.
Well, I think in one sense, Mr. President, I found them more relaxed than they were 2 weeks ago. They've had 2 weeks to accommodate to the situation. They found that disaster hasn't struck. They don't seem quite so eager, feel it quite so important to settle with them tomorrow, which was kind of atmosphere they had initially after hearing your speech. I think they're also more aware of the difficulty of the problem, the compatibility of our goals that Pete just mentioned. I gave them this $13 billion figure, which would be a shift from where we would otherwise be in 1972 or 1973, not a shift from last year. And this begins to penetrate. It isn't so easy for them to accommodate to, and they have some very real problems, obviously, accommodating to it. So in one sense, I think they are a little more relaxed in the short-term timing, more appreciation of the difficulty of the problem. At the same time, I have the feeling, and this is the other side of it, that they want a little more time themselves to think out what their strategy should be. And they've got some ideas, I suspect, beginning to germinate in their heads, so they're not all on our side of the issue.
Paul, did you say they? Let me ask this. Are they going to move in the unit, or if they're not, who are the wheels? Who are the people that really matter?
Well, they very much want to move as a unit, obviously, and they haven't been able to get together. And I think that mainly they can't get together at the moment because of the French. Nobody can quite figure out what the French are up to. And I think the French haven't resolved what direction they want to go in. They certainly have an urge to move together, and I think none of them are strong enough, so that none of them can take the lead and impose a kind of idea on the others. And particularly there's a conflict between the Germans and the French on this point, and that kind of silence. But I think I would not discount the possibility of moving together in a fairly near-term future, and I think there are probably some ideas beginning to move around in their head.
What's the attitude of the British, for example?
British attitude, I think, is a good British attitude. Don't just muddy the waters. Don't get in the way of our new bonds in the common market. Stay as close to them as possible. And they're moving clearly further from us. British.
Well,
they're moving away from us. They don't want to get
identified. I believe the problem answers and that every one of these countries is looking after its own interests.
Sure, they're all looking after their own interests. They're still trying to figure out how they can combine those interests. And
I guess
me very frankly in those terms. It's just a wonderful excuse for them to blame their internal problems on the monetary system or on the dollar or on the United States. And they're going to have a considerable problem controlling that situation internally. And I think quite honestly and straightforwardly, a number of them would like to see it resolved as soon as possible so they can maintain control over these internal political pressures.
Any support for the French position is sincere?
Yes, because that's one way of getting around this.
Who cares?
In fact, I was told, I think everybody in the common market would be inclined to line up this way. Some of them think it's very difficult, probably except the Germans at this point. And whether the Germans can be brought along as part of the compromise, I don't know. There's some proposals, I'm sure, percolating that they'll form a little gold block of their own and maybe change the price of gold as part of holding their rates together. But they would like to hold their rates together and then maybe float against the dollar as a group. That's one possible strand of thought. And the French are blocking that because they don't want to float at all, whether it's a group or individually or separately. So there's a lot of discord. There's a lot of ferment in Europe right now, an awful lot of traveling between these ministers. Every day, one of them's off in another capital, and they're all trying to align up some kind of a position for us next week. I don't think it was probably that quickly, but they're beginning to think in much longer range terms now, clearly, than they were 2 weeks ago when they were just in a state of shock and wanted to not open up their exchange markets and this kind of thing. It's got its good aspects, it's also got its bad aspects, because the more they can think about it, the more they'll think of the scheme. It's not in our favor. So the period of gestation is moving ahead, but I don't think we're under strong media pressure given their tendency toward fragmentation that they have quite a few percent over here.
This program, yeah, I think about four essential points out of all this is causally related to me. First, I think we ought to re-emphasize the travel that's occurring. The Italians wanted to come to Rome, went just to placate their feelings a little bit. While they were there, Schiller was in Rome. And Schiller was traveling all over there, all moving back and forth. No question what they're trying to put something together. And present a common front against us. They have already reached a fairly common front with respect to certain things. Number one, this government and their own countries are blaming the United States, blaming the dollar, blaming the monetary crisis for all of their domestic ills. They're using it as a political whipping boy. Consequently, the United States is getting extremely bad press. So this makes it politically more difficult for them to do anything. They all say that, well, yes, we know you've got a problem. We know that. But politically, we can do anything about it. And they all are they reach a common front. The next point is they reach a common front. But they really can't do anything about this now. The United States has to be back. And it's got to be in the United States action. Politically, it's unacceptable for them to rebound it. They just can't do it. Now, this is what you gained. Now, little things creep up, and Paul didn't get this direct, we got it indirect. One of the Italians suggested that because of the great interest the United States had, that probably the United States should not share, Secretary of Treasury should not share the group of 10, that probably ought to let fencing continue. Well, under the normal rules of the game, why, meeting the International Monetary Fund, the United States would succeed Canada as chairman of the Group of 10, which means I would chair it. But now they're already wanting to be sure that we don't occupy a position of any leadership, even in the Group of 10. So you get this kind of ferment, and there's no point in kidding ourselves, but what they're all moving to form this bloc, and I think they will, frankly. I think they're going to try to move against us. And I think they're going to try to form a
within the common market and have a different policy completely with respect to the United States.
I guess it's your view that we should retain our flexibility.
Oh, you just said, but you know that, just watching for a while.
I think I feel more strongly on that point. I know there are strong other views, at least from what I read in the papers, you know, among the economists and among the rest, that we should come in with a program. They never wear price control, raise price control, other systems and so forth and so on. It's our obligation because we are the strongest in our power to take leadership in setting up the monetary system. The point that I make there is the first two points. One, having taken the risks, and as we all know from our campaign meeting, we realize there are very potentially great risks in moving off our previous policy, and having taken those risks and written through, we're not about now to patch up, to temporize in attempting to pull the thing together again. I just think it's very important for us not to do that. I think before we move, we ought to be relatively sure that we can be in such a complicated area that we're moving to a new system that is one we can live with over a long period of time. There should be no, I'd just rather let it go along right now, let them fool around all they want. We'll be an island and let them be theirs. And as a matter of fact, as those charts showed, our interest in having a stable system are not nearly as great as theirs. We're a hell of a lot bigger market than they are. Our economy is a lot stronger than the dollar is. Shall we put it that way? The dollar isn't as weak as the American economy. But the second thing is that I believe that it's an opportunity for us when we do leave, especially can't wait too long, but when we do leave, to build a system which is more compatible with the world as it really is. My first two things have changed. The thing that we mentioned 25 years ago, Bretton Woods and the rest, the United States was an economic giant, everybody else was taking. We had to take the lead and went out, right? And we did. And ever since then, whether it's the FDRs or all the rest, the United States stepped in and we've been the great big statesmen, international statesmen of the world. We've done the right thing. And we should. And now there are lots of the giants. We're still the biggest, but there are a few others that are pretty big. You look at Europe, compare the United States, you look at Japan. I just take those two, that's enough. That's quite a business. And so here we are. We also have a situation where our friendly competitors abroad do move and are able to move in a much more controlled way we can tie monetary policy to trade policy, et cetera, than we do. We're just, whether it's monetary policy, trade policy, quotas, restrictions, or what have you, they can do move in a very precise way. The Japanese more so than the others, but the Europeans will get to that. So with looking down the road, that will be the pattern of the future. It's very important, seems to me, that we, and I know nothing about the monetary stuff, but we support a system in which we, with our great strengths and potential weaknesses, will be able to have a fair stake at the table. And I just don't think, and this is the thing I realize, I don't think that going back and patching up what we had previously prejudicing the subject, because it may be exactly right. I know Arthur has strong feelings on this. Not prejudice, that to be tied down by some arbitrary firm standard, whether it be a tie that gold or what have you,
the world is going to be, and also looking at its uncertainties. And that, that isn't very much in our interest.
Now, where we go, I have the slightest idea, but I think your idea, John, of keeping loose this time,
sitting tight, or keeping loose, whatever,
is exactly right. I don't think we know at this time. We don't,
but I don't think, and I would rush in too fast.
To prove your point, although there's less urgency reflected by Paul in his meeting over there now than it was 2 weeks ago, because at that point they had their markets closed, at least both of them, and they were alive, and so the sense of urgency is gone, dissipated to some extent. But nevertheless, they all still want to talk about reassessing the exchange rates, the fixed exchange rates. Our position has been, no, we need to talk about that. We don't want to talk about that unless and until we talk about commitments and payment form, until we talk about trade arrangements, tariff barriers and non-tariff barriers. Now, when all those things are settled, then we perhaps can talk about exchange rates. They don't want to do that at all. They say, oh, we don't even know what forum we can use to discuss those matters. But you can't use the group of 10, you know, or you can't use the W3, or you can't use anything else. They don't want to talk about those things. What they want to do, I think it's fair to say, they want to get back to a fixed exchange rate and get us back into the old system, and then they'd start putting on all the barriers again, administrative and otherwise. And we would be right back to the same place we got ourselves out of. And I just don't think we ought to move until we get these other non-monetary matters settled. And this is the trade matters, and who's going to pay for defense, and whether or not Japan is, and whether or not Germany is, and whether or not the Peru's going to buy French airplanes or American airplanes.
What is the situation on Japan, Paul? They fit in the picture. Which side are they playing with? Are they closer to the British?
No, the Japanese, I think, will play a somewhat separate game. Of course, the tendency on the European side is that they're more willing to talk about these other things than they ever have been, although they're still not very eager. But they're fine to say, well, so much of that problem is Japan. Go talk to Japan about it first.
There, too.
Japan has lined up, everybody has lined up on this gold thing, in the sense to say, politically, you must take the sacrifice of changing the gold price. And Japan, you might have thought, was the least likely to take that point of view, because they hold very little gold, and they've never been interested in changing the gold price. Even they have lined up on that issue. But the Japanese know that they're going to be the subject of special attention, so when you're in a general meeting, they lie pretty low. The others are inclined to say, we agree you have all these problems, but the impression is 90% of them is which is
kind
of
a lot of artificial.
Well, I think we've done very well on price to go publicly, but I think in these private discussions with the Japanese, the minute the subject comes up, we should cut them off.
Yeah, I agree.
That's what I
try to all of us say, that this is, let's not just even discuss that, it's impossible, so don't waste any time on that.
They've discussed this among themselves, they've all agreed to take a common line on it against this. I tried precisely that technique in these meetings. As soon as I introduced it on the agenda, I made my little speech just like you suggested, but they went on and talked about it anyway.
Is that your view?
Just cut it off. Cut it off right away. Otherwise, you're nothing.
Well, gentlemen, we go on, but we, you know, the meeting's left. Let's take the
goodwill tour.
Not just in the United States, let's talk about that. Two-year program in the United States. You captured the imagination of the American people. The American people felt something should be done. They're happy that it has been done. Paul McCracken and the policy committee of the council has done an exceptional job. And he's been chairing the council while I've been gone the last 10 days. And outside of one or two little uncertainties, there are provision, one on teachers' pay, that's about all.
Dividends.
It's just been dividends have been unusual, unbelievable acceptance of the program throughout the country. It's reflected in every way, in every walk of life, in every economic status. I personally talked to people in all walks of life. I went to the yard, the commission yard. I talked to the commission. I talked to the ranchers. I talked to the cattle buyers. Ranchers, rich and poor. I talked to the bulldozer operators, the clerks of the drugstore. I talked to business leaders. And I can't find any place in any strata, economic strata, where they didn't think it was a good thing. Now, I must say, they're all so uniform, without exception. They're unanimous up to this point that we have to have a strong follow-on program. I've not heard one single person that takes the contrary. They think you cannot turn it loose, that you have to have a fairly strong bill. Detailed yet, not in just the terms of people I've talked to, because they don't know that much about it. They just don't think we can turn it loose at the expiration of 90 days, which of course everybody, I think, fairly well knows anyway. In the political circles, it's been like a bombshell, of course, in the Democratic case. They don't vote to do. As a consequence, they just get a few more candidates for president every day. Van Parkey now looks like he's going to run against Birch by Indiana, really needs to. that challenge. And Bill Anderson in Tennessee now decides he wants to surface under the ice cap, and he's going to enter the primaries, it appears. So just that one at the point where it's coming, Fox and I are coming loose.
$6 billion program for Muslims. That's $100 tax credit.
Oh, yeah, but he wants to give everybody in the country $100 except those that power automobiles. So that's about the limit. But they're all, frankly, they're all grappling and trying to scramble to try to respond and try to develop some kind of a program. None of them have been able to come up with anything at this point. We'll have, I'm sure, because of this, we'll have some tough days in the Congress. I think as much as possible now, we've established, I think there's only one really important thing that we have to remember, Mr. President. We've established a high degree of, you have responsibility and credibility now in recognizing what your problems are. Maybe admission, you came out in the open with them, you took some drastic action to try to correct them, and from here on, whether regardless of what it is, I think we just have to admit that maybe we made a mistake or we miscalculated or whatever, and just face up to it. And let's don't ever take a position now that would indicate that we're trying to cover up or that we're trying to hide something or that we're not being completely honest and candid with the American people, because I frankly think they're in a frame of mind to take whatever sacrifices are necessary, to do whatever is necessary, provided they feel like the leadership of this country is leveling with them on what has to be done.
We will have, as a way, we haven't set the date, the cabinet meeting. Are there any new ones? I have a few. And I would like to have a further report on this. Paul and John, George, and various people, I think, we're also going to, we're going to have the cabinet meeting. Agencies are going to have to cooperate on some of the budget.
immediate reaction because of the stunning shock of it. Because the court had the ever felt that everything in politics is mysterious. And of course, had a counter reaction after the shock that people started to come up with their own ideas. Finally, and what we have to do is to keep the offensive. The court be here, everybody be in on this offensive, including the state defense and so forth, as well as the the extent that you can, as well as the people that are on the cabinet committee and economic policy or the cost of the council and so forth and so on. And you can always throw some word into a speech or paragraph or so forth, it would be extremely helpful. But that meeting will be announced, and we'll go into that in greater detail at that point.
Without, Mr. President, without eliciting in any sense the contributions that all have made, I think appropriate that I point out here, I think Arnie Weber has done an incredible job. And I think General Lincoln has. I must say, he's not the most articulate fellow in the world, but in fairness to him, I think he's a hell of an organizer. He's just done an excellent job. And I think those two men carried an unusual burden and done it exceptionally well.
No question about that. Well, they deserve off the high marks. In fact, they've done a better job than Mike DeSalle talk, and I say that a whole lot. Thank you very much.
Thank you.